Hey guys, it's Meltdown, and welcome to episode 2 of Track by Track. This time around, it's Jesse James Dupree talking about Jackal's debut record, Jackal. This thing turned 30 back in 2022. It was released on August 11th, 1992. I mean, I Stand Alone, Down on Me, When Will It Rain, Dirty Little Mind, The Lumberjack, and a ton more. We're talking about Jackal's debut record today with frontman, guitar player, businessman, and all-around good guy, Jesse James Dupree, today on Track by Track.
This is Track by Track, a deeper look at some of rock's biggest albums from the artists who wrote them, track by track. And now, with today's album, here's your host, Meltdown.
And there he is, Jesse James Dupree. How you doing, Jess?
What's up, my brother?
I'm doing all right. Just hanging out here in Detroit City. I brought in all my Jackal memorabilia for the big show today. Of course, we're going to talk about the debut record. I even brought some booze that I didn't drink yet. So,
well, that's a rarity right there. A bottle that's not empty.
That's right. That hasn't been cracked open. That's actually from my neighbor's house. It was a Christmas present. I'm like, hey, I need that bottle real fast for some stuff. He thought that we drank it all. We're going to have to put some iced tea in it or something. But anyways, well, we're going to go back to the summer of 1995 for you here on Track by Track. And of course, it was August 11th, 1992. This is from 1995. This broken bar stool here is from 1995. But August of 1992, and that's when the debut record came out. Tell me about that, that whole experience of dropping a record at that time.
Well, I mean, you know, we came out right in the middle of, you know, the whole Seattle thing. I mean, you know, it was a Stone Temple and Pearl Jam and Nirvana. We were label mates for Nirvana on Geffen Records. Yeah. And, you know, it's you can look back now, hindsight being 2020, but, you know, we really, at that time, we didn't really think about it. It was the big Seattle movement. I mean, it was just starting to happen, but it was going on. And really quickly, you know, we found ourselves the odd men out because we were not from Seattle. We were from the far other end of the spectrum, you know, some Southern boys from Atlanta, Georgia. And just went in and recorded a down and dirty, greasy ass rock and roll record, and we were ready to share it with the world. And so we went out and just hit the road. I mean, we were very fortunate to be signed to Geffen Records because they, they still, you know, between Aerosmith and Whitesnake and Guns N' Roses and Tesla, and I mean, they had built that label on so many great rock bands. So we were at home, you know, even though they had Nirvana and they had Counting Crows and they had, you know, various other, you know, Courtney Love's band and stuff like that. We were still very much in favor at the label, and they embraced us. And, you know, the record came out and we never looked back. I mean, I think we released over half of those songs on the album were all released as singles, and they all charted up inside the top 10, you know, on the rock charts. You know, as a matter of fact, Down on Me, The Lumberjack, When Will It Rain, those were all top 5 rock tracks. And so in the middle of that craze that was going on with the grunge scene, you know, it was pretty amazing that we were able to literally cut through. And we did just that.
Yeah, you said it, though. You pegged it. It's a down and dirty, greasy rock record that came out in 1992. And talk about working with Brendan O'Brien.
Well, I'll talk about working with Brendan, but, you know, I got to tell you, I mean, greasy rock and roll, down and dirty greasy rock and roll, it never goes out of style. Yeah. I mean, you can have all the fads and trends and, you know, the phenomenons of the day and all that stuff, and they're all great, and they're to be reckoned with and respected accordingly. But the one thing that never goes out of fashion is just some damn straight up celebrating the fundamentals of rock and roll, two guitar, bass and drums, chainsaw, if you will. You know, whatever it takes to get the job done. And generally find that, you know, that people that connect with the same philosophy that we have as far as celebrate the fundamentals of rock and roll, they get out, they come see a rock and roll Jackal show, and they get so tore up they don't even make it home before they hop in the back seat and knock out the old dirty. And I think that's where your kids were conceived, right? Right after a Jackal show. But you know, I also find that generally that people that don't connect with, celebrate the fundamentals of rock and roll, those are the same people that generally have a hard time admitting that they masturbate. And, so we, you know, we do celebrate those fundamentals of rock and roll. And we did work with Brendan O'Brien. I grew up going to see Brendan play in a band called Pranks. he was in a band called Pranks that were just great. They were in Atlanta, and I used to sneak into bars when I was underage. And he's only about 2 years older than me, so he was 18 and a badass, and I was 16 sneaking into the bars because the drinking age was 18 back then. But I used to go see Brendan, and I was just a huge fan of him. He was just a Joe Perry cool kind of a guy, just a great player. And he can play anything. I mean, play, you know, guitar, piano. He's just super multi-talented. And you know, when we got ready to record our first album and the record label wanted to find the next big producer, you know, they were looking for the next Mutt Lange or the next Jack Douglas or somebody that's going to be the next legendary guy. And I said, there's a guy named Brendan O'Brien, and they kind of laughed. They said, we want somebody that's going to be the next big thing, but not somebody we've never heard of before. But they had a meeting with him, and the next thing you know, he was producing our album, and Jackal actually gave him his first gold album for producing. I mean, obviously the records went on to be platinum and stuff, but we gave him his first award album. Stone Temple was the second, but then he went on to do everybody from, you know, Soundgarden to Stone Temple stuff, more Stone Temple stuff, Bruce Springsteen, AC/DC. I mean, you know, he's recorded, you know, so many people. You know, he's really a talented guy.
Well, I didn't realize that you guys pretty much gave him a start. I never heard that story before. That's interesting.
I wouldn't say we gave him a start. I mean, Brendan was going to be a badass and big time regardless, because there was no way you were going to hold him back. Mm-hmm. But I am proud to say we were one of the first, if not the first, to recognize his talents in the manner that we could get him his first gold record as a producer. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. So the record starts out with, I mean, one of just a great guitar riff, and I Stand Alone. This was obviously the first single that you guys released. And talk about that song and talk about the video.
Well, I Stand Alone was written about 2 years prior to that or so, maybe even 3 years prior to that. It was 1988 or 89. That song was written. I came off the road because I found out I was going to be a father, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to get back on the road again playing, because I had responsibilities that I had not had before. And I picked the guitar up, and I wrote I Stand Alone. And if you listen to the words, you know, you can tell, you know, I was feeling it at that point, because I didn't know if I'd ever be able to be even up on stage again, just with, you know, it's overwhelming as a young mid-20s guy having kids. You know how that is. And you grow up real damn fast. Luckily, I didn't grow up enough that I was able to still jump back up on the stage and make things happen. But thank God for my parents, who were able to afford me, you know, helping to provide a place for us to live while I was out on the road living on $5 a day.
Yeah. Now, that song came out just prior to the release of the album. I can remember playing it on the radio. Such a great rock and roll song, like I said, with the great guitar riff and everything. And then you got the backwards talking in there. You told me about that last time I saw you. You said, you got to play that backwards to figure out what I'm saying.
Yeah. So you go do that. You go do that and tell me what it says.
So that song comes out, and of course, just pretty much jumpstarts. Now, tell everybody, there was that lunch that you had, right? When the record came out, where you jumped up on table with the chainsaw. You said it was the most expensive dinner you never got to eat.
Yeah, there was a bunch of program directors from radio stations all over the country that were in Atlanta for a convention, and they were all eating at a big Longhorn Steakhouse. There's probably a dozen of them or so sitting at this big table. And we got wind of it, and we were shooting the I Stand Alone video. So we barged into the Longhorn Steakhouse with the chainsaw, and we cleared all their food into the floor, and I carved Jackal into the top of the table. And the other 200 people in the restaurant didn't think it was too amusing. And we ended up having a little bit of a rigor mort that day, and we kind of bolted out of there, but they filed a class. I went to jail. They arrested me. 2 days later, they came and got me. The night after, they raided my mom's house, because that was the last address they had me listed as. They raided my mom's house and looking in all the closets trying to find me. And but I turned myself in on the third day, and they booked me with reckless endangerment. And then right after that was a class action lawsuit that cost us $1 million. And the rest is history. But I'd do it all over again.
Now, was the video shot at the Kmart down the street?
That was the same day. The footage of the Longhorn didn't make it into the I Stand Alone video because the judge confiscated the footage for the trial.
Okay. Gotcha. So the record goes on in Dirty Little Mind, another one that that got a lot of airplay. Tell us a little bit about that track.
Well, I Stand Alone was first, and then they were gearing up to go with they were actually going to go with Down on Me next, and they had singles pressed, and they were about to ship Down on Me to radio, and then the Lumberjack broke up, and because some asshole started playing it on the radio nonstop. Do you have any idea who that is?
I apologize. It's my fault.
No, it's the record broke. It was something that everybody, quickly gravitated to. So the record company adjusted quickly, and because they couldn't keep the records on the shelf, and that record, exploded and carried us out there, and got us up over gold, and then Dirt Down on Me followed that and carried us up to where it was platinum, and then When Will It Rain came in behind that, and just the record just kept going, and then in between Down on Me and When Will It Rain, that's when they released Dirty Little Mind, so because they were letting everything get realigned, so that they could, push When Will It Rain. So as I Stand Alone, and then Down on Me, I Stand Alone, Lumberjack song, Down on Me, Dirty Little Mind, and then When Will It Rain. So all those songs were released as singles, and they all charted, just big songs. And then we moved on to Push Comes to Shove and Headed for Destruction and all, the next album, which, we, again, fortunate enough to have great airplay with those as well.
Well, we'll get into those other songs here in a few minutes, but Dirty Little Mind, who's the girl in the song?
It was just some random act of pornography that was happening that happened to be captured.
Oh, that's right. I think you told me this story. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was that was just a moment in time that just happened to work out. But yeah, it was, because back then you didn't have Pro Tools. They didn't have the kind of recording stuff that you with the computers and stuff that, we recorded it on the big 2-inch machines. So yeah. It was all analog, and it had to be recorded right there in the booth. So whatever was happening, there wasn't, you couldn't sample stuff necessarily. I mean, you had to grab it, so it was very much a in the moment kind of thing.
So Down on Me, another song with the double entendre, that song that said here, it charted 10th on the mainstream charts, but that was a monster hit for you guys as well. Tell me about that track right there.
Yeah. Well, Down on Me was, I actually had written Down on Me, several years before we recorded the first album, because I was at a party and the singer for Kansas was there, Steve Walsh. Hmm. And Steve Walsh, those people were at the party and they were complimenting me on the band, how there was another band that I was in and at the time, and people were because the band was doing really well, packing places out. And so Walsh came over and started a conversation. And he goes, yeah, we should write together sometime. So I took him at face value. I thought he was being sincere. So I went back and I was just coming off the road because that was right around the time I found out I was going to be a father. So I was coming off the road and I went in and I wrote Down on Me for Kansas. But I heard a whole other production with it. I heard it being kind of a Foreigner, I Want to Know What Love Is kind of a song. I feel the sun shining down on me, I feel the heat, that kind of thing. And with a big production and the chorus and all that stuff, a choir, I heard a choir singing on it, Down on Me. And I carried it, tried to get Steve Walsh to jump in with me on it. And he just kind of blew me off a couple of different times. So I just said, screw it. And then we ended up getting signed. And this is totally the truth. I swear on my kids, this is a true story. So that happened about a year or two before we got signed. And we get signed, and the record company, John Collider, was sitting in our pre-production studio in Atlanta, and we're in there running through. He wanted to hear every song that we'd ever written. So we worked everything up, including Down on Me. And I recorded, we worked up Down on Me because I was going to let him have a song that he could throw away. In my head, I still heard this real overproduced ballad with Kansas singing it.
Right.
And out of the blue, right after we played that song, Steve Walsh walked into the rehearsal room.
Really?
Because he heard John was there from Geffen Records, and he walked in to say, hey, to John. And John was going, look, guys, it's Steve Walsh, Kansas. You know, we're going, hey, Steve. So Steve left, and John goes, how cool is that? You know, Steve Walsh just came in, you know, to see you guys while you rehearsed. I said, yeah, you know that song that we played a while ago, that Down on Me song? And he goes, yeah. And I said, I actually wrote that for him. And I said, but he blew me off. He didn't ever want to do it, you know. And John goes, well, you know what the moral to that story is, Jesse Dupree? And I said, what's that? And he goes, you've got a hit. He don't.
That's right.
and that was way before the song was ever released as a single. But John just had a way of knowing. That's why he was the man at Geffen Records, right?
Yeah. And John appears in one of your videos. We'll talk about that coming up here in just a little bit. When Will It Rain, another track that just made huge waves for you guys as well. Tell me about that one.
Well, so my son was born and he was colicky, Nigel. You know, everybody, a lot of people know Nigel, and because he's out playing drums and stuff, doing great now. But Nigel was born and he was colicky, and I was managing a bar, and I was out till wee hours of the morning closing that place down. And I'd come home and my wife would say, basically, here, you take him, you know, because, you know, she'd been wrestling with him. But I'd finally gotten into sleep, and it was freezing cold outside. And I went downstairs in the basement because I was living at my dad's house at the time. And I went downstairs in the basement and I set a little four-track recorder up on a sewing machine, my grandmother's antique sewing machine. And I sat down there and froze my ass off with a little drum machine and a four-track recorder writing When Will It Rain about the heat being so hot it was burning holes in my shoes. And When Will It Rain, basically, you know, saying, when am I going to get a break kind of a thing. You know, that's what that song's about. And so I wrote that song. So then we get into the studio and, you know, a year later or whatever, and that song ends up making it to the recording session. And Kolodner from the record company, John Kolodner, he goes, you got to change that lyric. He said, nobody wants to know from rain. And so I rewrote the choruses about five or six times, and we'd send him down demos of the different choruses. Finally, Brendan, we were finishing the record, and Brendan goes, look, John, it's When Will It Rain. That's what it is. I mean, you don't like anything else he's done. That's what it is.
What were the other options?
John goes, hell, I don't know. I was just throwing so many things against the wall trying to come up with ideas, you know. And the one was Long Way From Home, or just it was just whatever, just a bunch of different stuff that can't remember everything. But then the single was released, you know, well into a year plus of the first album, and, you know, we'd already had a huge successful record. It was doing great. And the song came out and it went up the charts and upside the top 10, upside the top five and whatever. It's doing great. And the floods broke out up and down the Mississippi River. And the Mississippi River was, you know, 10 miles wide. And so radio stations were having a hard time continuing to play it.
Right.
Because of the rain. And so we ended up not hitting number one with that. We thought that was going to be a number one single. You know, we'd even done crossover versions of it and everything because it was so researched, so great. I mean, the research on the song was incredible, but radio stations stopped playing it because they had rained for 60 days straight. And John calls me up. He goes, see, I told you, nobody wants to know.
He had the last laugh on that one.
Yeah.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
Redneck Punk is the first song on the record that was not written by you that I know of. Jeff Worley and Ronnie Honeycutt says I got the writing credits on that one. So what was that all about?
Yeah. Well, Ronnie was singing with Jeff and them before I did. I was booking when I was off the road when Nigel was born, and I was booking them in to play a bar that I was managing. They had Ronnie was singing with him. He's a great guy and a really great guy. And And but I would sit in with them and sing. They wanted to play some of my, you know, they wanted to play I Stand Alone. They wanted to play, you know, some of these original songs that I had prior, you know, to Jackal. And so I, you know, I gave them a little cassette tape. So I'd get up and sing some of my songs with them, some cover songs, and the place would just pack out. People wanting, you know, no, you know, you can get up and jam with them. Y'all gonna jam, you know, because it was just a good chemistry. So it was pretty obvious. And then I wasn't going to be the jerk that broke up the band. So I didn't really say anything. I kept my mouth shut. And then finally they came to, you know, Jeff Worley came and he goes, man, why don't you just come sing with us? Cause it works, you know? And again, that way he kind of gave me a get out of jail free card. Cause I didn't want to disrupt what they had going on. But so that was, we were all thinking the same thing. So we jumped on it and it's been a match made in hell, man. We've been just driving it and beating the hell out of the road and ripping the hell out of guitar speakers and cabinets, and everything else.
That that last line when you go, shut up, how many times did that take?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I was so full of piss and vinegar back then. I mean, that was the easy part. I mean, okay. getting me to calm down and actually sing, you know, because I mean, I was just so jacked. I mean, I was ready just to scream. You know, scream it all onto the tape, and it was, but we were very honest about where we came from and who we were, and I don't think we ever, you know, we didn't go into the studio and try to be something we're not. And Brendan, going back to Brendan, you know, Brendan was the perfect guy to capture that because he's a guy that just believes in letting it rock.
Mm. And Redneck Punk will actually come up later on in the record. We'll talk about that. But as the first side closes, the Lumberjack. Obviously we were talking about it earlier, but the story goes that we were playing I Stand Alone at the radio station I was working at in Buffalo, and my boss threw me the CD and said, play something else off this record. So I listened to it, and of course I have to play a song with a chainsaw on it. And I'll tell you what, dude, to this day I've never seen the phone lines light up so fast. People went bananas. And then you know, the old story is that, you know, you actually came and played a free show for us at the radio station, and it was just jam-packed. But I mean, when is the first time you pick up a lumberjack and I'm sorry, a chainsaw, and think I should play this?
Well, my standard answer is, you know, why not? What more definitive instrument for rock and roll than a chainsaw? It's loud, it's aggressive, it's destructive, it's stanky, it's everything that rock and roll should be, right? It came about honestly because we held the sales and attendance record at a bar in Atlanta. And I knew we were going to break the sales and attendance record that night. So I threatened the owner of the club. I threatened him. I was going to bring a chainsaw in and cut the place up because it was just all wood. Mm-hmm. Just the big bar had the wooden canopy that came down with the glasses hanging under it and stuff. And so I knew I was going to get away with it. So I went and rented a chainsaw, and I went by Walmart and got some mailbox letters and spelt the name of the band on the bar. And I was cutting stuff up that night, and the owner was losing his mind. He was an excitable guy, and it didn't help that he didn't shy away from doing cocaine. So he could be wound tight, but he didn't fire us because we were making too much money. But at the end of the night, we were all jamming, and it was customary at that place, you know, you'd get other guitar player buddies up and let them jam. And so you'd jam on something, you know, a blues tune or something. And so all the guitar players were taking turns playing their lead break, showing off for the girls. So I pulled one out bigger than theirs and jammed on the chainsaw. And then I carried it back to the touring place and forgot about it. And my dad happened to be in the audience that night. He goes, you need to keep doing that. And I said, yeah, whatever. And about 2 weeks later, he shows up in South Carolina in a car. And my dad never rode in a car. He was always on his Harley. And so it was rare to see him in a car. But he opened up the trunk of the car, and he pulled out a brand new chainsaw and said, you got to keep doing that.
No kidding. And so then you go to record that song and tell everybody about the studio.
Yeah, we recorded the record in the Captain at Tennille's studio, the 70s hits, you know, love will keep us together. You know, that those and Muskrat Love and, you know, all those big hits that they had. They also had the Captain and Tennille TV show, a variety show that used to come on. And
this is in California.
They owned it. Yeah, they in Canoga Park, just in the valley, right, just north of Hollywood. And but Guns N' Roses recorded Appetite for Destruction there. Motley Crue recorded there. Aerosmith recorded. I mean, everybody and their brothers recorded at that place. When we were recording our first album, the Traveling Wilburys were across the hall from us, and Ted Nugent, the Damn Yankees, were down the hall. Wow. So, I mean, it was a very rock and roll studio. It was a great place. And that's where I saw my first Beatle with George Harrison. But anyway, so, yeah, and at night when everybody would leave, we'd go up into the attic, and the captain and Tennille had a bunch of props from their TV show. So the captain had a big captain's hat and just crazy stuff. And we had went and bought 40 chickens and roosters, and we let them loose in the studio. The whole time we were recording the record, the chickens and roosters were running around the studio. And at night, they would all go into this old drum booth that we didn't use. It's just an old 70s drum booth that they used to put the drums in to isolate them back when they would record stuff in the 70s. And so at night, they would go in there and roost. And every night, we would record the Lumberjack song because it had to be captured live. So we'd record it live every night. And the producer would come out and stand in front of me with a microphone, and he would chase my chainsaw with the microphone, holding it so that he could, you know, make sure he captured it. And then I'd bar into the stool and everything. And actually we were cutting up furniture and stuff at the studio. And John Kalana from the record company called one day. He goes, "They tell me you're cutting up the captain's furniture." And I said, "Yeah." And I thought I was in trouble. He goes, "I don't give a damn if you cut up that recording console." He said, you better be making a great record. So it's pretty cool. But, so yeah, at the end of the Lumberjack song, you can hear me. I throw the chainsaw down and I ran into that drum booth, which was right beside where I was standing. And he followed me with a microphone, and the chickens were in there, and I went, "Yeah, yeah," and the chicken, bah, 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 bah. But all those were real. I mean, again, all that had to be recorded in real time because of the way it was back then. But so it'd be Dirty Little Mind or whatever. It was just all done right there in the studio.
Now, you mentioned John Klodner a bunch of times already. Well, he was in that video for the Lumberjack.
Yeah, he was the school teacher. But, I mean, that was a rite of passage. I mean, if you got John to be in your video, you knew you were going to be successful because Sammy Hagar had him in I Can't Drive 55. He was the judge. He's an Aerosmith. Dude Looks Like a Lady video with Aerosmith. He was the guy, the bearded guy with the wedding dress. Mm. He was in that band Thunder. He was in their video. He's been in a bunch of videos. He's quite a character himself. He's great.
Yeah. So we go to the second side with Reach For Me. This is like maybe the love side of Jackal, eh?
Yeah. That's probably, you know, I was reading a article with Angus Young from AC/DC, and he was talking about I guess it's the last song on the Back in Black album. I think it might have been Back in Black. It was one of their albums. It might have been Highway to Hell. It's either Highway to Hell or Back in Black, but he was talking about, I think it was Highway to Hell, maybe, that the last song on the record was, he looks back and, it, you know, he thought, wow, that probably didn't fit with the rest of the songs, but it did. You know, I mean, we've all grown to recognize that's what it is. And Reach For Me was, although I love the song, and I think it's great, but it was probably the one song that I felt was a little different than the rest of them, but it went on there, and it had a great chorus. You know, I mean, it was a big song, a real big production song with the vocals and everything. You know, it's a lot of work, and it's up there. It's range wise, it's up there. It's in the key of B. It's in the key of B. So it's up there.
Yeah, because if I'm not mistaken, if memory serves me, one of the songs you're singing really low throughout the whole song, maybe Brain Drain or Back Off Brother, you're singing over the bass line. I'm trying to remember now as we're just talking here. But
probably Brain Drain, yeah.
We'll get into that here in just a few. Back Off Brother, tell me about this song. I have a couple notes on it myself, but just give me your memories and your thoughts on writing that song.
We've been playing Back Off Brother recently, and people just, I mean, the response has been incredible. It's just one of those tracks on the first album, but you know, it was right around that time in the early 90s that the government started politicizing racism. I mean, not that racism, nothing to, racism proper exists in all walks of life and with every race. You know, I mean, it's just out there, you know, but the government started using it as a tool, you know, and then religion became something that was politicized, you know, with people attacking the TV preachers that were giving Christianity a bad name, you know, with the Jimmy Swaggerts and, you know, people like that. The song was basically just an observation, because at the time all that stuff was fresh as far as fresh meat. Now we're also, I mean, you can't sneeze and people are calling each other racist or homophobic or whatever, you know. I mean, it's really crazy, you know, how, you know, society has changed even since the first album, you know, but all that was fresh back then. You know, censorship was where they were trying to put parental advisory stickers on the record, which on the Down on Me video, you know, we're on the parental advisory, that stage is a big parental advisory sticker, you know, because it was so all of that stuff was fresh in the early 90s. I mean, that was, so Back Off Brother was me venting about Back Off Brother, you know, because, you know, you can find racism, you can find bad Christians, and you can find, government corruption, you can find whatever. But I mean, at the end of the day, I live thinking that generally people want to do good and they are good, just inherently, you know, I don't look for the bad in people or for the good, but that's the song basically saying, but Back Off Brother.
Yeah. That's probably as political as you get on this album.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it goes into a brain drain.
Telling Uncle Sam to kiss my ass. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's right. Exactly. Going into a brain drain, Jeff Worley and Jimmy Stiff wrote this song. Tell us about that one.
Well, Jimmy and Jeff, I mean, you know, they grew up in the sticks of South Carolina, and, and they know, you know, they had some old backwoods guys that would pour, you know, shoe dye through a filter and drink it, you know, if they could get drunk, you know, I mean, just, you know, guys that, you know, find any way to, you know, to get drunk if they couldn't afford a bottle of liquor. And they grew up around those guys in the backwoods, you know, guys making their own moonshine and that kind of stuff. And, you know, and so brain drain, you know, was kind of a common term used in the South, and, you know, especially with some of the, you could get poisoned from drinking moonshine out of a still. But I mean, you know, obviously Jeff would do a much better job of sharing where they were at when they wrote it. It wasn't hard for me to wrap my head around it and sing it with everything I had. You know, it was a great song.
Yeah, and that's one where you actually bring up the redneck punk again, so it kind of comes back.
Yeah, and I get to play. I played harmonica in it, so that was fun.
Yeah, and that song has a strange ending. What was that one of your guys' decision in the studio?
I guess I don't know. So much of the stuff we did was.
I think it kind of started to fade out, and it was almost gone, and it came back up real fast, or something like that.
Yeah, because we couldn't. You know, we didn't know if we were going to just fade it out because it was a long ending, or if we were going to end it because we had to play it live. It was all captured in the moment.
Yeah.
So the Brendan just faded it down and then had it. So we kind of got the best of it. We faded it and had a big ending. So that's called having your cake and eating it too.
Yeah.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
And then we got a couple of love songs to wrap up the record. Just Like the Devil. That's like, that's a relationship type song, isn't it?
Yeah. Just again, that was, you talked about a song that was, just full of, you know, fire and brimstone and another ball buster. I mean, that's in the key of F sharp. I mean, that's another one that's up there, you know, I mean, as far, you know, range wise. So it's not hard to power up really good on that one, and the lyrics seem to require it.
You've had a couple of songs just like this one. What's that? I may be drunk, but you ain't right. Is it? What was?
Just because I'm drunk don't mean you're right.
Yeah. I've been diving in this record so much all over the weekend. I forgot which one it was. So, and then we wrap up the album with, just a pure classic. She Loves My Cock. How many times have you played that one live?
We've played it live every single. I mean, we've played it live every single show for 25 years or so. I mean, we change it up. I mean, it depends. I mean, if we're doing a NASCAR event, we don't play that song. Right. I mean, we pick and choose. We pick and choose when we're pulling that one out. But it's always it's always a fun song to play. It's a great rock and roll riff, man. Although it doesn't say redneck punk, it's a very redneck punk song, you know.
Yeah. So what did John Klodner say about that song?
He was all about it. I mean, he loved the attitude. He loved where we were from. He used to love coming to Atlanta. That guy I'm telling you, we were so blessed. He was our Jesus, you know. I mean, there's nobody. I mean, we knew we were broke, dirt poor. I mean, dirt poor and broke. And we had showcased for all the major labels. And they were all calling us, wanting to sign us. I mean, we had Simon Potts, who had signed, like, I think, U2 or something. We had Jason Flom, from Atlantic Records. I mean, he was calling. I mean, I was having to live at my dad's house because I couldn't afford to stay anywhere. And Jason Flom called my dad's house wanting us to sign with Atlantic. And I literally told him, I told all of them, we want John Klodner to sign us. If he passes, I'll call you back. Mm. And we were hungry and dirt poor. But so confident that we knew what we had. And so we didn't jump at the first record deal. We had major, major label heavyweights. You know, I mean, Jason, Kid Rock, Matchbox 20. The guy's the mega, mega A&R guy. I think he has Avenged Sevenfold now, but I mean, he's a mega music titan. And same thing with Simon Potts and all these other people that were, Nick Turzo, all these other people that were coming to see us. But we were like saying, no, we're good. We're going to get signed by John. And we didn't know how we were going to get signed by John. He hadn't seen us or nothing. I had to threaten our music attorney. I threatened him physically. I mean, I'm not ashamed to say this, but I probably shouldn't say it legally, but I threatened him. I threatened to go to Nashville and find him and tar and feather him if he did not deliver John Klodner. And he did. John signed us on the spot. John cared us. They told us, they said, John's going to come see you play. Don't expect him to stay for the whole show. Don't expect to get to eat dinner with him or anything, because he's just in and out, you know, and you probably won't even get a chance to meet him because he's probably just pop in and out. So we said, okay, you know, just as long as he pops his head in and out, we'll be okay. And he ended up showing up. He watched the whole show. He came down front with that notepad of his, a little leather binder note thing that he made. So that Sammy Hagar and Steven Tyler, everybody talks about John's notepad. So he came and he made notes while we were on stage. He came back into the dressing room after the show, so we got to meet him. And then he says, I'm going to take you guys to lunch tomorrow. So we were going to get to eat with him. So anybody that was wanting to take us to eat, those record company guys, we were making them take us to big fancy dinners because we were, hungry and broke. And so we'd go to expensive places. But John goes, I'm going to take you guys to eat lunch tomorrow. We said, okay, great. So we thought, well, if nothing else, we'll get a big meal out of it. And he goes, meet me at the food court at the mall. So we met him at the Lenox. Well, luckily they got a decent food court. So we sat in a California Pizza Kitchen. And we sat down, and he goes, I'm going to sign you guys under two conditions. One, you don't come off the road. You got to stay on the road. And we were like, yes, because we didn't want to get pulled off the road. You know, a lot of guys would pull you off the road and make you go write a bunch of songs. We'd already written a bunch of songs. He goes, you don't come off the road. You got to stay on the road. And we said, okay. And he said, the second thing, he looked at me and goes, you got to lose 7 pounds. It wasn't 5, it wasn't 10, it's 7. For some of you, you got to lose 7 pounds. And he goes, I want you to look hungry. And so I sit there while they eat lunch and I didn't eat.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. So,
and I by the way, I probably weighed about 155 pounds at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
How many songs did you write for this record that didn't make the record?
There was probably another double amount of songs that, you know, some of which, you know, Secret of the Bottle, ended up making it on a record eventually. Yeah. Trying to think of what else eventually made something. There was a couple of bonus tracks, a song called Walk and Change that you can find that's out there. It was a B-side to When Will It Rain, I think, single. So there's a handful of songs. There was another live version, I think, of Redneck Punk that we recorded in Seattle. And the guys from Nirvana was at the show. And we broke into I Stand Alone. And they started slam dancing, and Nirvana got kicked out.
They got kicked out of a Jackal show?
They got kicked out of a Jackal show for slam dancing.
Yeah.
And so I ran over to the road manager, and I said, you got to let them back in. And so he went over to the side door, kicked it open, and they came back in and stood on the side of the stage, and they were drinking draft beer out of gallon milk jugs.
Mm.
Yeah. And we ended up having to help Kurt get to the car that night. And I mean, sitting in Courtney Love's lap like a baby. It's kind of funny, but yeah, that was all crazy. Again, that was all before everything had really broke for either one of us, you know?
Yeah, no kidding. Real fast, last thing here for you. Tell me about the cover artwork and the back artwork of the record. Whose idea was that?
That album, it was a discussion that we all had. And I was meeting with a guy named Michael. I'm trying to think of his last name. His credits are on the record. But he was the art director. And we were talking about having an album cover of all of us as dogs. And if you look on the back, there's a photo shoot we had done. So we did a photo shoot, and that drawing of the dogs is mimicking the photograph on the back of the album. And there was actually other photos from that shoot on the inside of the sleeve of the vinyl. But the artist that did that was the guy that, that originally drew the Smokin' Joe Camel cartoon for the Camel cigarettes.
Oh, really? I didn't know that, man.
Yeah. It's a French guy. And Johnny Dare, my buddy Johnny out of Kansas City, you know, the radio guy down there, Johnny found it, tracked it down within the last couple of years. He tracked that guy down and bought it from him and sent it to me. So I've got the original painting from that Jackal album.
Wow. That's cool. So is that like a bigger record, a bigger picture?
It was actually done pretty close to size. I mean, it was done because he had to draw it and then they had to photograph it.
Okay.
So it was, he painted it and then they shot it. And however they did that. And, but yeah, so the actual original painting was close to album size.
Well, Jesse, thanks so much for doing Track by Track here with me. Of course, August 1992, that debut record came out, and it's been a whirlwind ever since.
You know, we've been very blessed, and it's all because of the people that support, you know, our diabolical lifestyle of rock and roll. I can't tell you how much we appreciate everyone. I mean, look how long you and I have been tight with each other. I mean, you've been along this whole ride with us, and you've seen so many shows, you and I have done so many interviews, we just don't take it for granted. I mean, we value all of our relationships with the likes of you and everybody that's standing in front of the stage every night, not coming to see the Jackal show. You come to be part of it, right? Mm-hmm. And very blessed, and we're not going to stop too. We're celebrating 30 years of Jackal this year. And since that first album, it's our 30th anniversary. So I'll mention that since you happened to highlight it. But yes, our 30th anniversary of the first Jackal album, and we're no sign of stopping. We're going to keep knocking down some memories.
Awesome. Well, can't wait to see you again, Jesse. Thanks so much for doing this.
I appreciate you, Rob. Have a great day, man. Keep rocking. You're doing a great thing, man. Seriously, I'm proud of you. All the stuff you're doing is great.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks.
And there it is, the story of Jackal's debut record, Track by Track, as told to us by none other than Jesse James Dupree. Hey, thank you guys so much for watching. Don't forget, episode one of Track by Track is up as well, as Brent Smith talks about Shinedown's first record, Leave a Whisper. In the meantime, I'm Meltdown. Thank you so much for watching and listening to Track by Track.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.